podcast fra E24.
Det sommer, og det reprisetid, også her I E24-podden. Men de beste historiene fortjener en runde til. Her får du en episode vi mener vil vært et nytt lytt. Riktig god sommer. Den verdenskjente Oxford-professoren Ian Goldin ser økt risiko for verdensøkonomien, og det mye som kan gi investorene sjokk. Også en ny finanskrise kommer. I E24-podden går den tidligere vicepresidenten I Verdensbanken gjennom hvilke farer som lurer, og hva småsparere kan gjøre for å forberede seg. Velkommen til en ny episode av E24-podden. Jeg heter Sindre Heyerdahl, produsent Erik Holm Nyvold. Denne gang har vi intervjuet Oxford-professor og globaliseringsekspert Ian Goldin under årets storebrandkonferanse I Oslo. Det også verdt å nevne at Goldin, som blant annet har vært vicepresident I Verdensbanken, forutså at vi ville få den globale helsekrisen I form av en pandemi. Samtalen foregår naturlig nok på engelsk. Ian Goldin, welcome to E24 Podden.
It's a great pleasure to be with you.
It's a great pleasure to have you here. We are sitting by Holbergs Plus in the central Oslo district, and you are soon to speak at the Storebrand conference here. Let me just start by asking you to shed some light on systemic risk. It's quite a world we are living in right now, but we still see stock exchanges near all-time highs. It seems that at least some parts of the economy is just pulling through still, but how is the risk assessment from your perspective now?
I think that systemic risk is endemic. It's part of the system, what I call the butterfly defect of globalization. Complex systems integrate and become quite unstable. And what happens now is something that starts very far away, very quickly touches all our economies, all our lives. We saw this with the financial crisis of 2007-10. We saw it with COVID-19 in 2020-2021. These shocks, and we should expect them to continue. This is the cost, I'm afraid, of being an open, integrated economy. There's nothing we can do, I think, to completely isolate ourselves. That would be a disaster. North Korea is the only example of a truly isolated country, and it gets stuck in the past. It doesn't grow. Its people end up in poverty. So being open and integrated is necessary. We get investment, we get skills, we get technologies. And most of all, we are able to cooperate. The tension, the rising tension in risk, is because while our systems and the world is more integrated, both through things we design, but also natural systems like climate change, pandemics, which we don't design, but they happen and impact us. While that is increasing, the governance, the coordination is weakening. And that means that there's likely to be more risk because we're managing it worse. The pandemic management system, for example, today is worse than it was before COVID-19 because the USA has pulled out of the World Health Organization and the US main institution, the CDC, Center for Disease Control, is a shadow of its former self. So the system is weaker. The same is true on climate. There's less global coordination because the US has pulled out of the climate agreement as well. So we should expect more risk. And the challenge for a country like Norway and the challenge for investors is how to manage this and how to work with others that want to work together to solve our shared problems. The point you made on the stock market not reflecting this is, of course, very real. We see record stock prices at a time of rising risk and a time of tariff escalation, a time of the conflict in the Gulf and elsewhere. And this is something of a paradox. I think it's explained mainly by two factors. The first is that the stock market boom is rather narrow. It's mainly technology stocks and very few technology stocks.
Yeah.
And then those that are also benefiting it from the growth of data centers. A company like Caterpillar, for example, is not a technology company. It's an earth-moving construction-oriented company, but it's benefiting from data center development. And the same is true of some others that are developing new energy grids and so on. I think that's the first explanation, is that this boom is not really widespread. And if you look at the average stock globally, there hasn't been a significant improvement. It's a narrow boom. And the second is, I think, that we have to put our money somewhere. and we're all getting richer.
Yeah.
And this is a challenge which I will talk about at the Storebrand conference today, is that although the U.S. now only accounts for about 20% of the world economy, it's 70% of listed equities and stocks and other traded assets. And that means, together with its overwhelming presence of the U.S. dollar, its exorbitant privilege, as it's called, of the U.S. dollar, means that there's the alternatives, the alternative investment opportunities, particularly in Asia, which is now, you know, should be over half of our investment, cannot be because it's not liquid enough.
Yeah.
And so this is another reason I think we're seeing this rather strange stock market system. It's fragile, and it's important that people investing their money understand the fragility of it, and that they have as diversified a portfolio as possible.
And you touch upon that we have a great interconnectedness, but we then lack the global cooperation we maybe even had in prior times. Do you see any possibility that we get back on track and are able to mitigate risk better because governments again cooperate more, or is that era just simply not coming back in the foreseeable future?
I think we will. The question is, how many accidents do we have before we get there? How much damage is made before we wake up? And in a way, we can compare the First World War and the Second World War. And, you know, the First World War was a ghastly war, and there was an attempt at cooperation and stopping conflict after it, League of Nations and many other things, but it was a disaster and failure, and the reaction was more protectionism and nationalism against risk, which, of course, was behind the Second World War.
Yeah.
But in the midst of the Second World War, cooperation was built. The United Nations systems, the Bretton Woods systems, welfare state, all of this, the idea of Europe, all of this came out of the war. But it took two wars.
Yeah.
And a lot of suffering. And people that had experienced the previous suffering, like Roosevelt and Churchill, who had lived through the First World War, and the parents of people that died who had seen this repeat, to realize we cannot carry on this path. So we will get there.
Yeah.
The question is, at what cost and when? Meanwhile, I think we need to have coalitions of people that work together. And Norway has been very good at its participation in this. Most of the global problems, or most of the systemic risks, can be managed by a small set of actors. We don't need 204 countries to agree everything to stop a financial crisis. Even climate change, 80% of emissions are from about 20 countries. And big companies are very important in that. If you identify what the risk is and then ask, how do we stop this? Or how at least do we reduce the risk, even if we can't eliminate it entirely? You end up with a constellation which is much smaller of the actors. And many of them are governments, but many of them also are private companies Obviously, mining companies, oil companies are important in this. In the case of the fight against HIV/AIDS, pharmaceutical companies are important. They're also important with vaccine development, for example. And cities and other actors in the U.S., even if the federal government does not agree to participate in, for example, climate negotiations, many states like California, New York, Michigan want to, and many cities and citizens want to, and many companies do. So I think the system we have in our heads, which is it's governments that need to solve our problems, which is very much a post-Second World War United Nations governance response, is a bit unfit for 21st century purpose. We need a much more variable structure of who engages in problem solving, which coalitions are built, and we need to make progress even if we don't get to ideal outcomes. So let's not allow the best solution be an enemy of a good solution to stop slow climate change, stop cyber attacks, conflicts, reduce climate change, etc. And I think that requires leadership in new ways. And countries' middle powers, like Norway, can play a very important role in that.
As the world looks right now and at the track the world is on right now, what do you think could happen risk-wise going further now? Could we have a new financial crisis or a big economic crisis? And could we have several in the years to come?
Yes, I'm afraid. I don't want to be a bringer of bad news, but I think the answer is yes. We should expect more crises. The one I worry most about is pandemics. I predicted the pandemic of 2020. The reason is that more people with more animals in more crowded places creates the conditions for super spreading pandemics with more airports and super spreading means. So anything can be anywhere in the world really now in 36 hours. But also the risk is rising of human-made, man-made pandemics with what's the number of labs that are synthesizing materials, new genomics, and so on. So I think that risk is increasing while the governance has weakened because the World Health Organization, the national institutions, the anti-vax campaigns, all of these things are compounding the risk of a pandemic. So pandemic remains a big threat, I think, and it can come from anywhere. I think other climate change is clearly an escalating threat, extreme weather, everything that comes with it, rising oceans, storms, floods, droughts, etc. Extreme weather, I think we have to expect. We're doing too little, too late. And therefore, we're way beyond 2% average increases in temperature. But of course, averages don't matter. It's the extremes for farmers, for shippers, for everyone that matters. And we should expect more of that. Yes, I'm afraid we will get another financial crisis. The only question is what form will it take and when?
And from where?
There's various possible sources. I think the one that worries me most at the moment is cyber, particularly alternative currencies, Bitcoin, Ethereum, and so on, highly speculative. They don't really have a fundamental underpinning. And even the so-called stable coins, which are often marketed as having a stable underpinning, are very difficult to look through, and governments find it very difficult. I'm not against cyber currency. I think we should have a digital euro, for example, but that's underwritten by the central banks with regulation from central. That's very different to private cyber currencies. Yeah. And they are becoming very significant, and they're integrating into the real economy because people are using them to buy assets, to hold shares, etc. So this is one potential source of risk. Growing dangers of fake identity, scams, theft, and I think is another related source of risk. So cyber vulnerability is increasing. And that, of course, could trigger a crisis if it leads to a run on deposits in an institution, failure to match assets and liabilities in the large financial institutions. And there's also issues around the wiring of the system, the traffic, the information flows, and there are some bad actors out there. I think another source of instability, and I'm sure Norway feels this strongly, is Russia. I think Russia is the most dangerous country in the world, much more than China. China has an interest in the future. It has everything to play for. It's the biggest beneficiary of globalization, and it needs rapid growth to sustain its power. Russia is in a rather different situation. It's a country which really has built itself on fossil fuels, which we hope to get to net zero by 2050. In the long term, it might be the breadbasket of Europe, but that with a long lag as Siberia becomes warmer, etc. And the demography, it's one of the very few countries in the world where life expectancy is going down. And that's not only because of the war in Ukraine. It was happening before that. So Russia worries me, and it's a worry for Europe. So I do see not only conflict like in Ukraine, but also destabilization of our democracies in various ways, including possibly leading to a financial crisis. The other sources of conflict, obviously what's going on in the Gulf now is very worrying. Hopefully it will be resolved, but we keep having false promises on that.
Yes, and the so-called ceasefire, it's still going on with bombings.
Exactly, and then like the ceasefire between Israel and Lebanon and Gaza, tragedy really for people in the region. And then there's the worries in the South China Sea and Taiwan. I don't think that a rational actor in Beijing, in other words, I don't think President Xi would willingly invade Taiwan, because it would be disastrous for the Chinese economy. I think at the very least it would lead to sanctions. It could lead to a financial crisis. It would dramatically slow not only world growth but Chinese growth, which is extremely important to keep the Communist Party strong. So I think it would be self-defeating. However, it could be provoked. If someone stood up in Taipei and said we're independent, that would provoke conflict. If the U.S. said it, it would provoke it. And there could also be an accident. We know from the terrible history of Europe that wars are often started by accident.
Yeah, that's
so. So that, you know, as both sides militarize around Taiwan, the chance of accident rises.
Yeah, and even though China and the Taiwan question might not be the most probable cause of the next big crisis, just the fact that if it is, then we will have a massive crisis makes it important to follow it,
yes.
Doesn't it?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. I think it would be extremely destabilizing for markets. I mean, just one example. Taiwan is a core producer of chips for advanced computing. The tech bubble we have now, which is the whole story behind the growth of equity valuations, would collapse.
Yeah.
You know? Now that one probably would lead to, on its own, lead to a financial crisis.
Definitely. And you mentioned the tech bubble, and we happen to do that a lot. It seems even those investing in it understand that the valuations now are very high. Could that burst one day soon?
Yes. I think the valuations are not realistic. If you look at the expense spent on data centers and infrastructure and the potential revenues, it's clear not all the companies investing are going to be able to generate that revenue to make sense of these scales of investment. And there's also a lot of cross investment. For example, Google owns 8% of SpaceX, I think. But there's a lot of cross investment and ties between these different companies, and of course between some other companies that supply them, like NVIDIA. So it's very fragile. There will be a correction. Not all of them can win. How it will play out and how big the correction is a key question. And a question which is coming very soon, of course, is that we have some big IPOs coming. SpaceX, OpenAI, Anthropic. $2 trillion dream. I mean, I think it's on the very high side,
yes.
to value SpaceX at $2 trillion, but that's what they're dreaming of. But the question is, where's the money going to come from? Is it going to come out of existing tech stocks? In other words, it's a reallocation of tech portfolio, or is it going to make the tech dominance of the stock exchange even greater? And I think the answer is some of both. But mostly new institutional investors rather than the reallocation of tech, which means tech will be even more overweight.
Yes.
In people's portfolios. And so I think this is getting more and more fragile.
As a small or big investor in Norway, how should he or she now think about the risk picture? And as we touched upon prior, the ruling thought now that the fear of missing out makes people stay in the stock market. How should we think about this going forward?
Well, FOMO is a big problem.
Yes.
Because no one likes to be making 4% on government gilts when you can be making 25% on the stock exchange.
Exactly.
and institutional investors that try and allocate, let's say, 30-40% of their portfolio to stable, low return, but positive stocks get criticized and don't get in the top quartile. So I understand. I mean, I've been an investor on many investment committees, so I understand this and I sympathize with it. I think the question is partly what one's time horizon is. Are you a long-term investor or short-term investor, pension fund or not? If you're a long-term investor, you can ride out booms and busts. If you need the money and you're going to lose your house, or you can't educate your child if there's a bust, that's a more serious question.
Yeah.
So one is, what's your time horizon? The second is that I think it's incredibly important to be diversified. I do believe that a balance between stock market exposure and gilts or, you know, good positive earning plus inflation plus earning real assets, but bonds is important as part of the portfolio. And we're still seeing very decent yields in the market.
Yes, we are.
They're going to come down. But part of the impact of Trump's very misguided policies on tariffs and is to keep interest rates higher than they should be.
Yes.
And we should benefit from that. They're not going to stay high forever. So I think a diversified portfolio, the challenge, as I mentioned, is that we should be much more diversified to emerging markets, because that's over half the world's economy and growing at two to three times the rate of the old advanced economies, Europe and the U.S., we should be much more exposed, but the problems of getting in and out.
Yeah.
The problems of liquidity. But then one can think about which companies which are traded in the advanced economies or in liquid stock exchanges like Hong Kong, Singapore, and others give you that exposure.
Yeah.
Yeah. To basically emerging market growth, which will be, I think, sustainable. And growing at much faster rates than the old economies will be sustainable over the next 10 years or so. So I think we need to diversify. It's, There's a lot of worry at the moment about diversification into private equity, which was another form of diversity.
Yes, we had the debate in Norway as well regarding the oil fund, and if that massive fund should be allowed to invest in private equity.
Yeah.
So far, it isn't allowed, but I'm sure the fight is going
on. Yeah, and it's, you know, at the moment in that fight, I think there's some real worries about the liquidity and exiting from private equity because there most probably was an overinvestment in it as part of diversification strategies. Norwegians and Norway are incredibly fortunate to have the sovereign wealth fund. You're very lucky. You're the envy of the world. It's been very effectively managed. And you all are richer for it. But obviously, it's there because the asset is not going to be there. The underlying asset, which is the exploitation of oil and gas, is not going to be there in the second half of the century in the way it has been in the past. And so building on that, using it, including, and I think I know this is a somewhat also a subject of discussion in Norway, to diversify the Norwegian economy, is also, and including through infrastructure and education, et cetera, I think is also very important.
Because we are quite concentrated on some sectors, and a lot of it has to do with raw materials.
Yeah. Yeah, and the raw material, well, there's oil and gas, obviously. Other raw materials for Norway, fishing, other raw materials, very important. But diversification towards where I think Norway in the long term will have a comparative advantage, which is the knowledge economy. And you know, it's a very skilled, educated, small, open economy. And if you look to an economy like Singapore, which is not that different in size, a bit smaller, it's basically all knowledge economy. They have no resources at all.
That's something to learn from.
Yeah.
But when we have touched upon all those risks, and then that Norway is such an open economy, so exposed to the world economy, we could also hit rough waters if the risks bloom out and become real crisis.
Yes. I think, again, you know, Singapore is even smaller and more open than Norway, so one can learn from it and other places. Yes, I think the future is more unstable in the sense of shocks. But Norway's been through shocks. You know, it's been through the world wars. It's been through shocks in the past, the financial crisis, various oil crises, etc. So it's not that it doesn't know that things are not stable. That's part one of the reasons to create the sovereign wealth fund. So I think it has that ability, given its asset levels and knowledge levels, to manage it. But clearly, it's a small economy in a turbulent world. So the relationship with NATO, the relationship with the European Union, that's absolutely the key, absolutely central. But the European Union is not small. You know, collectively, the European Union is the same size as the US or China.
Yeah.
So I'm a great believer in that. And I think that Norway's future is a European future. If Europe succeeds, Norway will succeed. If Europe fails, it's very difficult to imagine a happy future for Norway.
And maybe both Britain and Norway share something here that we can't forget Europe, either of us.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, we, in my view, made a disastrous mistake with Brexit. At that time, just over 50%, it was very tight, of the population thought it was a good idea in a referendum. Now, well over two-thirds think it was a bad idea. Okay, so there's a lot of regret in Britain, and we're seeing it in the economy. I mean, growth rates have slowed, investment rates have slowed, And partly because of Russia, we want to be much closer to Europe on defense and on other things than we did at the time of Brexit. So, yes, it's a regret, I think, but there is a recognition, and I think it's a recognition even in the extreme right-wing nationalist parties that our future is with Europe. We can't say, some politicians are now saying we need to rejoin, although I don't think it's going to happen soon. And, you know, I think Europe also doesn't want countries just to jump out and jump back in. But through the back door, in other words, achieving many of the things that membership achieved without membership is, I think, something. And I guess Norway's on the same path.
Excellent. Ian Goldin, thank you so much for this interview, and good luck with the rest of the program here in Oslo today.
Thank you very much for having me on your program. It's been a real pleasure.